Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 9th of July. Very nice to have you with us. And first of all, before we get started on today's show, I just want to give a big shout out and a thank you to everyone who had anything to do with yesterday's broadcast, our WAMC On the Road broadcast at the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We had an amazing time. And it was really so special. We had these incredible arts leaders with us during the panel. We had five amazing artists who talked about the work that they do as well. And of course, a big thanks to all of the teams at the Alliance, as well as at the Colonial Theater, and of course, our crew, who did an amazing job putting it all together. And just a huge thank you and hugs for making that just a really fun, great broadcast. So it's good to be home. Very nice. But it was fun being on the road yesterday. Very cool. All right, let's get to today's show, see what kind of trouble we can get into. I think we're all up for that. And we begin with the introduction, or the invitation, I should say, for you to be with us. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you. Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham, is with us. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good to be here. Thank you.
Really nice to have you on the show once again. Our good friend Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob. I will give you an honorary Bob title today, so we could Bob along today until Heather gets here.
Yeah,
so,
that's good. Yeah, very nice. This is Robert, and that is Bob. That's how we did it last time. That's how we'll do it this time. And yes, we're waiting for Heather Mulligan, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, who will be with us momentarily. And we welcome you again, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, let's go to the news of the day, and we'll begin with the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court clearing the way for mass firings at federal agencies. The Trump administration can move forward with plans to slash the federal workforce and dismantle federal agencies. That was an announcement made by the court on Tuesday. The decision could result in job losses for tens of thousands of employees at agencies, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development, State, and Treasury. The order, which listed a lower court's ruling that had blocked mass layoffs, was unsigned and did not include a vote count. That is typical in such emergency applications, although Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson did write a public dissent. The case represents a key test of the extent of President Trump's power to reorganize the government without input from Congress. The justice's order is technically only temporary, guiding how the administration can proceed while the challenge to Mr. Trump's plans continue. But in practice, it means he is free to pursue his restructuring plans, even if judges down the road determine that they exceed presidential power. That from the New York Times, and we check in now with our group. What do you think, Robert?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack here, Joe. First of all, I think the court was following precedent in a sense, in that they really didn't want to have a position where a president must have explicit statutory authorization from Congress on personnel decisions in the executive branch. That has been consistent with the way that this court has been thinking. There will be lawsuits. This will go forward, no doubt, and there will be lawsuits from a variety of quarters on this overturning of that Northern District of California court that had temporarily paused it. I think we're going to see some more action like this. To me, what's really interesting and tragic about this is that unlike the Big Beautiful Bill, which in a way you know, scoots most of those painful cuts to after the 2026 election. This is going to be, this can be implemented today. And I think we're going to see pushback from not only the unions involved and not only political action committees involved, but I also think that there's going to be some knock-on effect that this administration hasn't thought about. 29% of this federal workforce of 2 million people are veterans. 11% of all veterans work for the federal government. That's equal to all the number of people in the United States who have manufacturing jobs. So when you start talking about powerful groups like veterans that are going to be caught up in these cuts, I think that the administration is going to be surprised by the pushback it's going to get from quarters that usually don't push back.
And the pushback, I'm interested in the fact that they didn't anticipate the pushback. Because you think they would?
I don't think this administration thinks
second
or third order principles at all.
Yeah, okay, I understand that. All right, Bob.
Yeah, it's in following up on Robert's comments, I actually believe the court was correct in the decision, in part, and this is an important nuance. The way I interpreted the decision is that because there wasn't actual harm, that the executive orders were more about direction to plan for, that the court said we're going to wait until there's actual harm. This is also, though, where I thought Brown Jackson's dissent was also correct, saying, you know, wait a second, is that if you're going to wait for the house to have burnt down, then that's a really silly thing to do, and you overstepped, you stepped on the toes of the lower courts. So I actually sort of agree that both elements of both the dissent and the ultimate majority decision, which again it was a two paragraph decision. This isn't a full case.
Right.
So I think that's important.
Which is typical in emergency decisions.
Yeah. But let's talk about a couple of things that that this does. And I thought Robert's comments about the veterans in the workforce was really important. I'll also note that the continued cuts to the federal workforce mask exponentially larger number of cuts to contractors. The ripple effect of the changes to the federal government, I think, are and continue to be or will continue to intensify as a drag on the overall economy. And it's interesting looking at some of the economic numbers. I don't see a rosy economy. I'm even more pessimistic about the economy than I have been. And this is still without the Taco Tuesday tariffs situation really, really kicking in. The other part of the conversations that we should be having is, again, what's not going to get done? And part of the reason we're, you know, your question, I thought, Joe, was spot on about, well, you know, didn't they think there's going to be pushback? Yeah, they think there's going to be pushback. They don't care.
Right.
And part of what they're doing by basically dismantling the federal bureaucracy is that they're wiping out decades and decades and decades of experience with the idea that in order to rebuild the type of experience that the federal government has had, it will take multiple generations. So the idea that anybody is going to be able to come back and put Humpty Dumpty back together again is going to be false. So even realizing that, and this is all part of Project 2025, that by being able to break the expertise of the federal bureaucracy, you achieve a couple things. One is that nobody's going to be able to tell you no. They can claim that they're dealing with this fictional deep state power base, and they're going to then be able to pick and choose what is going to be implemented, even when Congress approves it and it's signed into law. there's simply not going to be enough people to do the job. And I don't know if we're going to be talking about the flooding further in the show or not, but if we're not, you know, FEMA already has lost more than a quarter of its workforce. Okay, and that's not even that quarter isn't even articulating those that are out on injury, those that are out on leave. I mean, so you're, all of a sudden you're starting to think about a workforce that is down or been cut by, maybe 30%, maybe 40%, and then everybody's going to question why an agency can't do the job they're doing. Think about your own workforce if you suddenly were reduced that way, and this is going to be a ripple effect that we're going to see through so many other agencies.
Can I follow up on that?
Of course. For a minute?
I think Bob's absolutely right here, and the lost part of this is the capacity of the federal government. I mean, these things, these systems and capacities aren't built overnight. I mean, FDR had to go through the Great Hurricane of 1938 to understand the kind of mobilization of what parts of the federal government needed to be. That paved the way for the mobilization, ultimately, actually, for the 300,000 people that are going to go into the Navy. You can't build that kind of capacity, knowledge, or systems overnight. And to dismantle in this quick a way is haphazard at best.
Heather Mulligan joins us, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
Excellent.
You know, fly weather, so I have to spray the horses and put their masks on and all that stuff.
Okay.
And I just have to come up with some excuse for being late every single time. So that's my excuse today.
You don't need an excuse.
Well, it's good to know.
Yeah.
I just reminded myself I actually have to feed the parking meter on my phone. But
yes. Yeah, don't do that because they're sticklers.
I don't need a ticket.
But remember, you're a volunteer, and when you get here, that's fine. Yeah, we'll do. We're all ready to go.
Okay.
So, what do you think?
So, a couple things. First, I do not agree, and so I've learned, like, I have to make sure that people understand when I'm saying something that it doesn't mean I agree with the underlying decision to get rid of a lot of federal employees. I do agree that that will have a long-term impact on an impact on the willingness of people to join the federal government. And of course, there are, you know, certainly people who are very talented who are lost. That being said, the Supreme Court is correct in their decision. This is the executive branch. The executive has broad authority over personnel in the executive branch. And back, I don't even know how long ago it was, when the Pataki administration took over New York government from the Mario Cuomo administration, this actual circumstance was tested at our own state court of appeals. And the finding there was that the executive has broad authority to shrink, eliminate, get rid of people who have been there, who considered themselves lifers, if they don't have civil service protection, and they were people who were hired for policymaking decisions for someone of a previous administration. There's no obligation on the part of the executive to retain them. That the protections of civil service, which I'm sure would certainly apply to many of the people who were let go of the federal government, can only be gotten around by doing broad shrinkage of agencies overall rather than, so, you know, saying we're going to cut workforce by 10% for economic reasons. They can't be singled out because of their political views or anything like that. But people who are in policymaking positions certainly can. So I don't think the Supreme Court's wrong. I think that's why there's only one dissenter, and I think they're correct. I just want to make it clear that doesn't mean that I agree with what has been done here. I also just caution people to use specific examples of terrible events to try and find a reason and pin the blame on something when it's very likely that this flood would have been equally as tragic had there not been layoffs at you know, federal agencies. I'm not saying that's 100% certain, but to try and connect those dots retroactively, I think is a little dangerous because that makes us look away from other things that need to be corrected as well. So I guess that's what I have to say about that in the words of Forrest Gump.
but there's the issue of the actual employees and how they're affected and the way in which this was done, right?
Yeah. But you know, Heather, I'll push back respectfully and say that you don't have to be a brain surgeon to say if you're going to reduce an agency's workforce, you know, overnight by 30 or 40%, that there's going to be a degradation of service, right?
Yeah, I mean that's definitely true. But if there were at 100%, does that mean that the outcome would have been different? And I don't know that we can say that.
I think you could make compelling cases that if you have 100% staffing, which no agency ever does, that their capacity to do their job is better. Now, yeah. is there?
But
you know, again,
their
this
job
gets
wasn't
me,
to do the warning here. I mean, it wasn't their job to do the warning. I mean, the system, the state itself decided not to implement.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is a conversation that we could have. I mean, again, further when we're talking about the flood, but you're hitting, I think, a really interesting question about what's the role of government, and what is the role of the federal government, and the definition of what government is and should be is being redefined before us by a series of executive orders, certainly without congressional input, without a public understanding of the impact on services or any of those debates. And I think that's the pushback that I appreciated in the Brown-Jackson dissent. And again, I think the Sotomayor's position, which she was spot on, that you have to wait for the plans to be implemented before you can claim damages. I think the court made the right decision, but I thought Brown-Jackson was apropos in her concerns.
And that is why I premised what I said by saying I don't necessarily agree with what was done. But the fact that there is executive authority to do this, I don't think is really in question. It's the wisdom of it. That's different. And the separation of powers, this is one of those be careful what you wish for kind of things. I mean, it to me, it's a parallel to the applicability of decisions, whether or not they should be limited to their region or nationally, because
we'll continue this, I promise.
Yeah.
We'll make it Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. The music this morning, Young the Giant, there in the open tour, will be at the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York on the 15th of July. You can find out more information by going to bearsvilletheater.com, bearsvilletheater.com. And you can also check out the playlist posted at wamc.org/roundtable. We were just finishing up a clarification as we went into the break as far between Bob and Heather. So, Heather, go ahead.
So, all I wanted to say was, while I don't agree that this was the best plan, that is laying off massive amounts of federal employees, because I think that for all the reasons that were previously stated, I think that it harms the functionality of government and government serves an important purpose. I do believe that the decision is correct, that this is within the realm of executive authority, and it is not controlled by congressional authority as to the ability to control the employees or to limit or get rid of employees in the executive branch. And I would suggest that on principle, You know, if you have a next presidential administration that is a Democrat, you certainly would want them to not have to rely on congressional authority to get rid of some of the folks that their predecessor had put in place, say, at Department of State or Department of Justice. So it's sort of like where you sit depends on your view of this. And I try and step back and say, underlying principle here, is the Supreme Court correct? And I believe that they are. I am again saying, and I'll just for further clarification, not saying that I agree with the actions that were taken by the administration, just that I believe the Supreme Court is correct in saying that the executive does not have to seek congressional approval to eliminate positions in the federal government. Now, some of those positions, he may need congressional approval because even in state government, in many governments, you need congressional authority to put people in place. That doesn't mean you need it to get rid of them, but there are circumstances where positions are protected and there is legislative oversight. But that's not the vast majority of positions.
And only Congress can get rid of a department. So if there's a larger goal here, it's going to run up against that guardrail.
Right.
Right now, at least, only Congress can get rid of a department.
And but I mean, this is where the courts need to sort of help define is that if it's a shell, if they're unable to fulfill the obligation, I mean, you can hollow out a department to the point where it's completely inefficient. And, you know, it's interesting, Heather, you raised two very important points. One is, I hope any aspiring Democratic presidential candidate is watching very carefully at how presidential power appears to be shifted. And sometimes I don't think that the Democrats play hardball as well when they have the levers of power. So I think what's good for Trump and the Trump administration, whatever comes next, hopefully it will be a regime change, needs to be in place. I also would say that sort of as a student of government, I still think it's a bad practice for the country to move away from a civil service that's protected from partisanship. The idea that the civil service should be answering to whatever administration and administration sets policy, the civil service helps implement it. That's the way I always understood it when I was in my career roles in the federal government. And we're going back, whether we like it or not, to more of a Jacksonian spoil system where the executive comes in, brings in all of its friends, which means that when the administration goes out, all of the friends are going to get either dug out or wiped out or asked to leave, which means that government isn't going to be more efficient that way. But again, this is a sort of a more theoretical conversation about how the federal government should operate.
So there's an interesting sort of, and this is going way back, I'm going to show my age here, but years and years ago, mayor of Schenectady, a guy named Ducey,
Mayor Ducey.
He hired someone to be his commissioner of police, and the city council was all Democratic. I think Ducey was a Republican. I'm not even sure if he was a Republican. He might have been an independent. He was kind of a wild card, I think, a little bit. But he hired a friend to be commissioner of police, and the city council promptly eliminated the position of commissioner of police. And I actually was working at the time as a volunteer attorney for the ACLU on behalf of the said police commissioner, because under New York state law, a city the size of Schenectady is required by state law to have a commissioner of police, which is something certainly I don't think anyone on the city council had ever looked up. And it's not something that the mayor himself was aware of, but I came across it. And so it ended up not being a freedom of association argument, but rather a, hey, you're not following the letter of the law argument. I think that commissioner of police subsequently was incarcerated for something. So, but but anyways, but it's a separation of powers argument, and then the override of existing law. Sometimes there are laws that apply only to specific things. And I think we're going to find out that some of the positions, some of the people who were let go from the federal government, there actually is not executive authority to let them go. But that is individual cases. That is going to take a very long time. It probably won't be resolved fully by the end of this administration.
Yeah, so. The lawsuit with HHS is going to take forever to feed through that. Yeah.
Yeah. Which again, almost gives by fiat the opportunity for the type of changes that are being questioned, because the damages will be done and will have been done for so long. Right. I mean, but this is also part of the challenge with the Supreme Court is A, you know, they pick which few cases that they're going to review, but B, they stretch years and years and years. I mean, the Supreme Court, it's not supposed to be an easy pass to the Supreme Court. There is supposed to be a steps that go along the way,
right,
which Heather, you could probably speak to way better than I can, but it means that people who are negatively impacted oftentimes don't see injunctive relief until decades.
Well, so there's different.
If ever.
Well, there's different standards, right? Mm-hmm. So injunctive relief, you can get very early on, right? Injunctive relief means this can't be further applied until we resolve a particular argument. And when injunctive relief is granted, it's because the party seeking it, the court has made a determination that there's a high likelihood of success on the merits. And that's actually what happened
here. So it's what happened with this case.
Yeah.
Then. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But
so injunctive wasn't the right word to use then.
Oh, okay. You mean reparations, really.
Yeah.
I mean, getting relief, getting any kind of financial settlement, any damages or anything like that, that takes forever.
Yeah.
And then you have to, you know, enforce it. I mean, against the federal government, it probably happens quicker than it does against individuals. I mean, good luck to anyone who goes to small claims court. Once you get your judgment, have fun. You're still, it's, you know, for the maximum amount of like $5,000 or something that you can go for small claims court, you're going to spend endless amounts of time and effort trying to recover that. But it's the process, you're correct, the process, and it's intentionally slow because what the Supreme Court wants is a fully formed question of law. They are not deciding on the is it good or bad. It's is it legal or not. And they're looking for a fully formed question of law. And in order to get there, you have to kind of sort through all the extraneous facts and issues, and you get to one fully formed issue. And that's why when they get a case, a lot of times people are frustrated that they're not deciding every aspect of the case. They're only deciding the aspect that is brought to them as a question. So it's not like, not like a criminal case, guilty or not guilty, and then you keep – there's always the issues get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, mm-hmm. and you get rid of the issues of fact, and then you get to the question of law.
We have two letters. I want to get to those, and then we'll move on to another topic after the break. We go to Peter, who says from David, you cannot run a country if the bureaucratic mechanism is changing every 4 years. There will be no continuity, no breadth of knowledge, no consistency in policy, just a cadre of new yes men every 4 years. That is a death knell for democracy. Then we go to Peter. The country's experience with Trump has clarified the differences between legality, policy, and effectiveness. We can observe that legal things may be done in pursuit of ruinous policy decisions and destroy the services that the executive is charged with providing. Unfortunately, though, we may wish legal sand might slow the gears. What remains is a political remedy. This is why we were reminded that impeachment is a political, not a legal process. And go ahead.
No, that's very true. I think that's a very excellent letter.
And your first letter, that's the reason why the Foreign Service was the Foreign Service and the Defense Department had a lot of career people in it. Because, yeah, you don't want to reinvent policy and build from the ground up every 4 years.
I would also say, I mean, that is the reason why I have always thought term limits were not necessarily a good idea for legislators, because legislators are the ones writing the law that relates to policy. And if you have a term limit, you often have very complex areas of policy where legislators have sat as a chair of a committee for years and years. And when they leave, a lot of times the staff goes with them.
Right.
So you don't have the expertise. And I mean, the best example I can think of that in New York is, I mean, Senator Kemp Hannon, for many years, was the lead architect on New York's healthcare, Medicaid, hospital policy. And he's no longer in office. And a lot of the institutional knowledge of the complexity of how New York takes advantage of, let's say, federal funding for Medicaid and all of that. He had a very unique insight into that you cannot learn overnight, and no one gets elected on those things.
And do you still feel that way? Because I used to feel that way, and now I think that the only way to fix the system is by putting term limits in to break the stranglehold that incumbency has been written into.
Well, I would argue the way to fix it is to fix the primary system, because right now in New York what we have is a churn. Because you have term limits in New York City in the city council, you have city councilors who their entire career has been either as a staff to the city council or a city councilor. Then they run out of time in that seat and they run for their local assembly seat or their local Senate seat. So they roll from the state to the city back to the city. And the city council positions, at least for a time, and I'm not sure if this is true anymore, actually had a higher salary than, let's say, a state assembly person and more glory, too. I mean, in New York City, a lot of people don't have any idea who their local assemblyman is, but their or assembly person is, but they probably know who their city council member is. But the term limits created this system where people just go from one elected position to another. They've got their campaign accounts. They got everything built in. And because of the way the primary system is, they can't, you know, it's very, very difficult to take out an incumbent in a primary. And the primary is the election in New York City.
Yes.
Quick letter from Fred. Is there a coherent judicial philosophy behind these decisions? Is there no responsibility to preserve a vision of balance in government? Or is it really true that this is Trump's court? That from Fred.
I don't think this is evidence of it being Trump's court. And when I was starting to say before about where you sit depends on how you look at things, you certainly, I think, if you have a different administration, you might take a different view as to whether or not the executive has the ability to select people who work for the government. And again, I don't agree with this. I just want to make it clear because people sometimes hear me and think I'm defending the administration. I am not. But I don't think that this is evidence that this court is in his pocket in any way. In fact, there's only one dissenter. So I think that would tend to indicate otherwise. I think this is strictly based on balance of powers. If we don't like the way the balance of powers are, then we have to fix them legislatively. Preferably, you don't fix that through a judicial decision.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue and we'll move on to other topics. I want to talk about U.S. weapons to Ukraine being resumed. We'll discuss that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Will return right after this. Hey, the rails are— Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we are talking about the news of the day. I want to change subjects and move away from the Supreme Court's decision yesterday and instead go to the decision that was announced yesterday in a— I'll leave it to be a very interesting cabinet meeting that President Donald Trump on Tuesday stepped up his criticism of Russian President Vladimir Putin as he reiterated plans to send more weapons to Ukraine to add in its war against Russia. I'm not happy with Putin, I can tell you that much right now, because he's killing a lot of people. Trump said during a cabinet meeting, we get a lot of BS thrown at us by Putin. We want to know the truth. He is very nice all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless. Putin is not treating human beings right, Trump said. So we're sending some defensive weapons to Ukraine. and I have approved that. Trump's remarks came days after the White House announced that the Pentagon had halted deliveries of some key weapons to Ukraine, which apparently came from Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, perhaps without the knowledge of the President of the United States, which brings up its own set of issues, but we can talk about all of that, Robert.
Yeah, I think the key word in all that is some. These are a very small cache of defensive weapons that have been sitting in Poland and are now going to be released. They're Patriots, they're Hellfires, they're Interceptors, all of which are desperately needed in Ukraine to stop this recent Russian offensive. But the numbers are small. For example, there's only 20 Patriots that are on their way. And so the pipeline that's usually there, it usually comes from two different stocks. One is a U.S. stockpile and another is budgeted that gets paid for in the materials show. This pipeline is slowed and the Russians have taken advantage of it. They have the capacity now to launch 1,000 drone attacks a day. And so if you have 1,000 drone attacks a day and you've got 20 Patriot missiles, you can begin to see some of the problems. So this slow trickle is going to have to increase dramatically, especially on the side of the Patriots and the Interceptors, if Ukraine is going to be able to put some of this off. I think the other interesting part of this story, it's a story that one of my former students, Natasha Bertrand, broke with her coverage, is this idea that this was not a decision that was made in a National Security Council meeting, but rather just at the Pentagon across the river. And I think this gets to actually our earlier discussion. This is one of the most hollowed out Defense Department senior teams you'd ever see. There's no chief of staff. There's not a circle of advisors around Hegseth. In the rest of the administration, I think you could probably say the same thing. Many people are just getting ready for their Fox News show that night. There's a reality TV show being planned by the Joint Chief of Staff every day, or by the Chief of Staff every day. This is the problem when you don't have senior people sitting down as guardrails on some of these decisions. I also, the criticism that Trump is launching toward Putin, maybe that's really how he feels, or maybe this is a cover-up for allowing almost a week to go by of constant attacks. But this isn't the way that you run a national security bureaucracy. This is not the way you come to decisions on foreign policy.
Heather.
I wonder, the thing that really struck me was the president's comments on Putin, that he's not a good guy, that he's hurting people. Using a lot of sort of, I guess, non-technical terminology just to say, like, he's an A, whatever.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is part of his... the way that he conducts diplomacy, and I think that's unfortunate.
Because conversely, he's also this week saying what a great guy Zelensky is.
Right,
they actually got to go along great during.
Right, so it's like, and it just it's
and
like,
that's no way to run foreign policy.
No, it's like the playground, right? Yeah. Like, this is my best friend. No, that's my best friend. He's a jerk, and. It just, that is the part that kind of stuck with me, is that, he's mad at Putin, so he's going to say bad things about him. It's kind of like how he was with, with Elon Musk and others. But we're talking about, national leaders, we're not on the playground. This is real life. And it's a little unnerving. I just, as an aside, and I'm always wrong with predictions, but I don't think Hegseth is long for his role. I think that he's going to probably flame out. And he's made a lot of errors. And I think even this administration has to see that.
Well, that hold my beer moment was brought to you by Heather Mulligan. I sort of categorize this both as personal and personnel. So with Trump, the comments about Putin more because I feel like he's been he feels like he's been insulted.
Right. Yeah.
This isn't about Ukraine.
He's been dissed.
Right. Yeah. It's that he's been disrespected. Therefore, his good friend Vladimir is no longer his buddy. Heather, I thought you put your finger on it. This has the feel of a schoolyard, dust up.
Yeah,
yeah. But the personnel issue is really interesting because, I think Hezgeth is going to take the hit on it. In a lot of what I've read, though, some of these issues are even further into the organization, where our national policy are being set by Trump appointees even further into the organization, which means that I'm not trying to defend Hezgeth, but there's a good chance he didn't realize some of this, and certainly I think Trump and the White House were taken by surprise. The concern for folks at home who may not have been following, because it's kind of fallen off the news, is that the war is actually seems to have intensified. In part, it's the season. It's the season of war. I mean, this is you given the winters and the ability to move equipment and people. That's why summer is the best time to fight. But there's the use of drones, use of aerial attacks, the targeting of civilian population centers, the tit for tat that's going on, and this is occurring from both Russia and Ukraine, where they're targeting. Both are targeting critical infrastructures further and further into each other's countries. So you are seeing an expansion of the conflict. The other concern that Robert raised that I'll go back to is getting material to the front line is not an easy process. So you think, well, it was only delayed a few weeks. That has just enormous consequences when you don't have munitions to fire and you're being fired upon. So that gap, while it can be sort of papered over as we're providing resources, everything is good. It's not good, and I think this is also driving our what we used to consider our allies. I'm not sure what we call them anymore, particularly with our NATO partners, taking additional steps back from us and our partnerships and agreements.
So I was going to just mention, two things. I think first off, it shouldn't go without saying that it's good. It's a good decision to send them more weapons. I mean, I think that's very important. And I think it's unfortunate that it's in the wake of a very, bad public statement that we're not going to be helping them out as much as we were. The other thing that is just an observation, Trump has had this long gripe about the NATO allies not pulling their weight. And I wonder if there was some sort of harebrained thought that, hey, they're closer to Ukraine than we are. They need to be doing more of this. And they're not going to do that as long as we're there solidly, being supportive. And our erratic support, our inconsistent support may force some of the allies to the table to do more for Ukraine. I mean, this is really the beginning, not the beginning, but we're in part of something that could turn into something much, much worse.
We'll continue this discussion. Good stuff. A couple of things I want to bring up as well. We'll get to it when we come back. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, First Messages and News with Ian Pickus. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Robert Brigham with us, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College. We also have Bob Griffin, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, and Heather Mulligan, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. www.bobbrg.org. We have been talking about weapons going to Ukraine and the president sharply criticizing Putin. I know, Bob, there was one point you wanted to make right before the break.
Yeah, it was just an observation off of Heather's comments about the strength of the country and how Trump seems to react, and talking about NATO and the idea that NATO wasn't doing enough individually. And I just find it interesting how we've adopted this mantle of victimhood in this country, as if we're constantly getting abused by everybody. We're so weak, and it just runs contrary to how I have viewed the country. I think it's part of the narrative that unfortunately seems to have taken root with a lot of people.
Well, benevolence in and of itself, because you're in a position to be benevolent, hasn't been valued here. And I think that's really unfortunate. I mean, USAID is the perfect example of that. The tremendous benefit that the U.S. provided via USAID to the rest of the world, because it's the right thing to do, somehow that is us being used or taken advantage of. And I don't think that's right. I think you've hit the nail on the head. Yeah. that we need to reclaim the mantle of, yeah, we are the best. We are great. And we're going to do the right thing. And we're going to do the right thing even if it costs us money. But that doesn't seem to be the current tone.
Yeah, and USAID is a really great example too, because the other side of that coin, besides doing the right thing, when people can live lives in their own locales, they're less likely to want to immigrate or move. But even more important is that was a way the federal government was able to help farmers. So you start to think about, you know, whether it's the rice farmers in Louisiana, or whether it was the wheat farmers, it was a way that we were able to strengthen our not only our moral obligations, but our provide financial support to our own critical infrastructure that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
It was also vaccinations for children in Africa. And yeah. I mean, really, really good, benevolent things that strengthened other countries, but also strengthened our relationship with the world.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that because we were good, we were perfect. I mean, certainly there was a lot of things that this country has done wrong. But, you know, in terms of the assistance that the U.S. has lent to other countries in the form of USAID and, military assistance, there's a lot more good than bad. And that part, I'm really sorry to lose.
Robert.
Can I dive down on the USAID for a minute, Joe? I'm lucky enough, blessed enough to have had two Purple Heart fathers. A biological father earned a Purple Heart at the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War, and an adoptive father earned a Purple Heart on D-Day in the Second World War. If my biological father, the Vietnam veteran, were alive today and was in Vietnam, he would say, my God, we won the war. And we won the war because of all the soft power that USAID has exercised in the last 50 years. Every senior Communist Party official in Vietnam has been trained at Fulbright University in market economics. If that's not what you want as a United States, as your foreign policy goal, implemented through soft power, you got more through soft power in Vietnam than you ever got in hard power. I think that's just one example of the kind of things that Heather and Bob are talking about. Another on the NATO issue, the United States has been crying about NATO, European contributions, European state contributions to NATO forever. But it depends on how you count that. A lot of these weapons have been sitting in Poland. Now, do the care for those weapons on Polish territory and all the personnel, is that counted? It's not now. Should it be? I mean, so all the Air Force Base in Shannon, all of the American bases throughout Europe that make it easier for the United States to do its job.
Or anybody?
I'm good.
Okay. All right. Everybody holding. That's good. Let me get to just a couple of letters. David, don't let's see. No. My wife was much smarter than I am, pointed out that the states have some power that they could exercise since the court is useless. Congress can't seem to keep the executive branch in check. Maybe it's time for the states to call a constitutional convention.
Which states would that be? New York, California, Vermont? I mean, I don't know. I don't know that there's enough critical mass there. I mean, I think two-thirds of the states are trifecta states, being both both parties and the governor's mansion controlled by the same party. And there's a lot more red ones than blue ones.
All right. Let's move on to...
No.
Okay.
No,
all right.
I mean, I've been seeing crazy articles. I mean, I just take them as sort of just crazy thinking, like, you know, that California, Washington, Oregon, New York, all the New England states, and then sort of the cluster of
well, not New Hampshire.
You know, of Michigan and that we know they should join Canada, that type of thing. It's the same thing, you know. Anytime there's a flip, you hear the same thing. You know, Texas threatens to secede from the union, and
always the upstate New York seceding from Long Island, right? Or from the rest of the state,
well,
from New York City. Sorry,
the Adirondacks always wanting to be.
Yeah, and in neither situation could they afford to do it.
No,
I mean whether they like it or not, the city funds a level of lifestyle that they would be both unwilling and unable to generate on their own.
Right.
Let's move on to another topic on this Wednesday morning. We want to go to what is a trade deal? I think this was an interesting article from the New York Times. The president is deploying the word deal liberally. This perhaps started with a book called The Art of the Deal. But using the term to describe all kinds of trade agreements, some very limited or one-sided, this allows us to also talk about just where we are when it comes to the most recent trade agreements and quote-unquote deals that are being made. The Trump administration is seeking deals with countries around the globe, telling major trading partners that it is open for negotiations before higher tariffs kick in on August 1st. But what constitutes a trade deal these days has become a tricky question. For the president, a trade deal seems to be pretty much anything that he wants it to be. While traditional trade deals run into the hundreds of pages and take years to negotiate, Mr. Trump and his advisors have been using the term to refer to much more limited arrangements. That includes the framework deal announced with Britain in May, which was only a few pages long and included many promises that still need to be negotiated. The president also used the quote-unquote trade deal term for the handshake agreement announced with Vietnam last week. In a post on Truth Social, he said it would be, quote, a great deal of cooperation between our two countries, end quote, and bring some tariffs on Vietnamese products down to 20%. But since then, neither country has yet publicly released any text or a fact sheet describing what has actually been agreed upon. The president has also recently taken to referring the trade truce his officials made with China in June as a trade deal, even though the agreement constituted only an agreement by the two governments to roll back the tariffs and other retaliatory measures they had taken against each other in recent months. A trade deal typically makes changes to the rules of trade, but this truce just returned the relationship to the status quo. That all brings us to yesterday's cabinet meeting, where Mr. Trump used the term deal to refer to one-sided arrangements that other countries had not consented to at all. The letters that he has been sending via his social media account informing governments of new tariff rates on their exports.
Could I buy you a cup of coffee, Joe? You said yes.
We have a trade deal
with Joe Donahue.
Well, wait, what did you get in return?
The ability to say that I have a trade deal with Joe Donahue.
Oh, I got you. That seems to be what's at stake.
I promised everybody back at the university that I was going to come back with at least five trade deals today, and have one.
And my company.
Yeah. Your company, yes.
There does seem to be one or two people in the administration who are saying, oh, wait a minute, 220 countries, there's no way we're going to do this by August 1st. So there is a sobering up maybe of the enthusiasm for all of this.
So there was a great moment, and so many of these things, you know, hit online, and so it's hard to put it in. Sometimes it's hard to put it into context as to day by day. Yesterday was Tuesday, but I believe on Monday the president was talking about the trade agreements, and it was Scott Bessent who kept on inserting himself and saying, well, in this case, a trade agreement would be this. And, oh, well, I think what the president really means is this. And there's this interpretation because as reporters were going back for more knowledge from the president as to what actually constituted a deal, it was Scott Bessent who was coming in and saying, well, we're going to do.
Yeah, and it's always awkward when the ventriloquist dummy actually ad-libs during the middle of the show. So, I mean, that's, you know.
See, Franklin Roosevelt had his Harry Hopkins. So Roosevelt had these grand big ideas that he would talk to in the press. And then he knew Harry Hopkins, who actually literally lived in the White House. He knew to go talk to him next because he was going to be the one that put this together. I don't think Trump has anybody.
Who's the details guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Who's the details person?
Well,
it's not the chief of staff.
Susie Wiles.
She's off doing her reality show. She's not concerned with day-to-day operations.
Well, she's dealing with all the departments, really. I mean, I don't think she's really steeped in, you know, foreign policy or trade. I think it's interesting to me that a piece of paper or a tweet is a trade deal, but USMCA, which took years to negotiate, is not. That's currently in place, but we're still talking about Canadian tariffs, or are we not? I mean, we were last week, so.
No, and it's interesting because, you know, again, to sort of put some context behind this, there are a couple of interesting developments. One, again, tariffs pushed to August 1st, so we're kicking the can down the road, which the markets are obviously watching. I will note that Fox just did a survey. I don't know if you saw the result. It was done in June, but the released pretty recently, where 57% of the Fox respondents think that tariffs hurt the economy. So there's issues there. I'll also note the reported tariffs on copper, and if you haven't looked at the copper futures, you have to. And boy, Joe, you know, my heart of hearts, it starts to look like just pure market manipulation by people at the White House. And somebody's making an awful lot of money off of these declarations.
By the way, we have field tested this, but there's nothing better for this show and its ratings than when we talk about copper futures.
Ooh, save your pennies, people. Oh, yeah.
The listeners just come running to the dial.
Yeah. Well, all you copper future fans, please write in to defend me.
It's time. It's time.
Well, wait, is the phase out of the penny part of this magnificent scheme? Or?
Well, this is, except that the penny has some ridiculously low percentage of copper. So it was funny because that was
scammed.
They're not.
Very disappointing.
Yeah.
Doesn't copper leave like a blue mark if you wear something made out of copper?
Yeah, it reacts.
It oxidizes or something. Yeah. Yeah. I don't have any copper jewelry, so I've got nothing to sell.
It may be more valuable than platinum before it's all said and done. But all of this sort of adds into this continued string along. And again, you talk about the chief of staff running a reality program. This just has the feel in so many respects of following the World Wrestling Federation sort of playbook of string them along, changing sides, flipping, you know, who's a villain one day, who's a hero the next day. And at the same time, we are continuing to isolate ourselves. I think there was a really interesting article, I think it was in the Times today, about how we've now economically isolated ourselves. And I'm thinking of the disrespect that we just showed Japan and South Korea, two of our most important allies in the Asia Pacific, and the fact that we've isolated ourselves even from our own European allies. Trump is touting two agreements, one with the UK and one with Vietnam. I'm sure the Vietnam agreement is in the pile of paperwork under the Epstein file on Bondi's desk. So I'm sure it's it'll be cleared any day. But the UK wasn't really agreement. That was just a re-signing of something that had already been done. So in reality, since he did his whole big board of tariffs, he's delivered zero.
Yeah. And the Vietnam one is very complicated because so many businesses moved manufacturing to Vietnam in order to avoid China. Yep. It's going to take really skilled negotiators months and months and months to put that deal together. So three pages is not a deal.
No.
He should have just gone to the Penguins and got an agreement there to say he at least got one done.
I mean, the Penguins. nice callback. I'm curious, this seems to be one of those times where we actually took a deadline seriously, sort of. In the sense that it was going to be 90 days, and now we're looking at 90 days, and then, I mean, it can be extended and it can move on.
We're definitely, totally not ever going to move this deadline. It's August 1st, right? That's what I heard.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think we've heard that, a variation of that before.
Taco.
I don't know if it's chicken. I mean, if you are actually working through something, right, you don't want to rush to the finish line if you're not quite done.
Heather, you sound like every student who writes to me about the fact that they didn't write their paper
before the end of the semester. Well, that was me, totally, too. I'm the queen of procrastination. Unfortunately, passed that gene along to some of my kids, too. But I guess what I'm saying is if it's really true that people have their sleeves rolled up and they're working through trade agreements, I mean, if it's not resolved on August 1st, it makes sense to extend the time frame. But it doesn't feel that way. It feels a lot less like that and more like I'm watching the Bob Newhart show instead of writing my paper, right? So
another Newhart reference.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, oh, that was off air though.
Yeah, that's
about
fine.
The fun
it's good.
Game.
No,
hi, Bob.
I like it. I like it. Let's see. This from Leslie. You seem bewildered by the lack of support for farms. I'm surprised it hasn't occurred to you that the game here is to bankrupt family farms so corporate agribusiness can buy them up cheap.
I don't think so. I don't think that's the plan. I don't think there is any such plan.
Yeah, I wasn't bewildered about support for farms. I'm just saying is that we have that our foreign policy did more than just help others.
It also helped farms.
Really helps us. And I mean, this is also like if you think about SNAP, the food assistance programs. Why is it so heavy in dairy? Because they purchase a lot of dairy goods in order to support the dairy farmers, particularly in Wisconsin
and New York.
In New York,
at which, by the way, border Canada and dairy is one of the sticking points with USMCA because the Canadian government has not honored its commitment under USMCA to permit U.S. dairy products to be freely traded. It's still very difficult to get American milk, cheese, or from the United States, milk, cheese, and even poultry. In Canada because the Canadian government has really put up a lot of barriers. But that is like the wonkiest little side issue there.
If that was our only sticking point with Canada right now.
It's not. It's not with USMCA. Yeah. It's not. Mm-hmm. There's some tech issues too, but dairy is a huge one. And part of the aggravation that this administration has had with Canada is dairy. It is because the president has heard from dairy farmers that they're not honoring their commitment. So that's why, I mean, part of the thinking behind, you know, not continuing under USMCA was there was a lot of advocacy done on behalf of farmers with the administration. So I think it's maybe a little bit of the opposite. There is a real problem right now with Chinese nationals buying up farmland in proximity to U.S. military installations, mm-hmm. Which I heard a story on this morning earlier before we were on air. And that is something that I think we should all be concerned about.
We go to this letter from Robert. I'm a customs and trade attorney. I've been at this for 30 years. They are not narrowing in on any deals. They will punt and continue to punt because their reciprocal rates have no basis in reality and would be absolutely ruinous. And that from Rob.
But it's interesting, Joe. You know, I've been thinking a bit about this, and I get more and more depressed. It's like after he's changed the whole world economic order, how do we fix this?
Well,
you know, I mean, I don't even
can I okay.
apologize, flowers, chocolates.
Yeah,
I want to focus on that just for a second. Let's take a break and we come back because you were actually the one that sort of put this bug in my ear. So I want to explore it just for a moment with you, and then we'll move on to other topics. Let's take a break. We'll be back. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org when we return. It will be our last go-around with this group. So if you want to get your letters in, now's the time to do it. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this short break. Listening to Young the Giant this morning, they're in the open tour. We'll be at Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York on the 15th of July. You can find out more information by going to bearsvilletheater.com. You can also see the complete playlist of the tracks we played during the bumper music this morning by going to wamc.org/roundtable. Back to Bob Griffin. Do you remember what you said right before the break of the thing that you wanted to ask, the big question? Yeah, you were asking, here, I remember. No, it's this whole idea of what we do next, right?
Yes.
And I was having a discussion with you, mm-hmm. I think, 2 weeks ago, of off air, and you were telling me what you were doing and within your department, within your work. And it was one of the first times I had heard someone talk about, okay, for want of a better term, okay, whatever's happening is happening. So let's figure out how, in the best way possible, we can put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Right. Yeah.
And this goes not just in your world, but in all of these worlds where we're seeing this, of if there is to be a semblance of normalcy once again, not that there isn't now, but if there is to be, what do we do? Because that infrastructure really has to be built now.
Now, right? You can't start in 3 years, and then hope to be able to impact. You know, again, I'm making an assumption that there's a change in administration. You have to be ready to go. And I, you know, whoever wins the next presidential election, the transition team is going to be probably more important in my mind than any time in history, but they have to have people that they can pull immediately at all levels, because mm-hmm. it's not going to be good enough to go in and say, okay, we can bring a cabinet of true adults back if you can't surround them with people that can implement what they're doing. And in order to implement what they're doing, you have to have everything from entry level to mid level that understand the systems of government to be able to hit the ground running from very day one in order to start to repair the damage. With trade, it gets a little, I think it gets more, certainly more complicated. And I think, you know, Heather, your points about the international elements, I think, are even more complex because so much of diplomacy is personal relationships. And honestly, it's not just trust of the United States, it's trust of the people who are representing the United States. And I remember in the time that I was working with DHS, you know, the number of years it took to develop the type of close working relationship with our international partners, which then gets wiped out when you lose all of the career folks. Mm-hmm. And Joe, thank you for reminding me of the conversation because really what the faculty and I are looking at UNCHC is how do we create a certificate program based around working in the federal government within the federal systems and in the different expertise that we offer so that we could create a pipeline of trained individuals that can go into the federal government because there's very few people that want to go into work in the federal government right now.
I can't agree with Bob more on this. You know, during the Cold War, it was Title VI. You built research centers of excellence that were bipartisan, and you had a streamline of PhD and area studies experts that did this. And then it became the purview of the think tanks. You know, if you were out of government, if your party was out of government, you were going to be either at the government school at Harvard or you were going to be at the Council on Foreign Relations or you were going to be at one of the think tanks. And now they're so partisan that ability to reach across the aisle and get all the good ideas wherever they are has been hampered by the very body politic we're practicing. So I think the first step for me, Joe, in what do you do next, is that you reinvigorate those centers of excellence so that we're ready on day one to bring all of the talent we have in this country together on big problems.
Does there have to be a full understanding of how bad it's going to be, or do you just extrapolate?
I think it's already that bad. I think you start now with the understanding that they can't go it alone. Nobody can go it alone.
Right.
So I think that we're going to find willing allies out there to do this kind of work with us, but we do have to start now.
I think there's knock-on effects that are going to be harmful that we as people have the ability to insulate against. So right now, if you knew anyone who said that they were going to work for the federal government, I think there's a lot of people who would have a visceral reaction to that. Like, why would you go? Why would you do that? Why would you help them?
Run!
And I think
run
we
for
need
the
to
hills.
Stop thinking about it that way because government service, regardless of who the executive is, government service is important and valuable. You think about people who work in the Foreign Service who have diplomatic relationships with people working in embassies who are staff, who are not elected officials or not political appointees. Those relationships, we are very dependent on them in terms of global diplomatic relations. And the more we discourage people from being a part of any administration, the more we are undermining the talent that potentially could go and be part of a strong future. And, you know, right now the country is so divided that the very thought of someone going to work for the federal government is going to provoke a visceral reaction from certain people. And we need to not do that because the service itself is valuable. You're in service of the country, not in service of the executive.
Yeah. And prior to the Trump administration, I thought one of the more interesting things that I experienced working in the federal government, especially as I started to work at some of the higher levels, was the positive interplay in interaction between sort of folks that were waiting to get back into government when there was a change. So when the Democrats were in power, mm-hmm. they were the Republican future leadership, would intermingle and they would talk through issues, and they would warn, hey, be careful. This is, where you're heading with this is going to create problems. It wasn't adversarial. It wasn't this, we're going to grind you to the dust. You're stupid. I can't, the dumb R's or the dumb D's or anything. It wasn't like that at all. It was
how do you sort of steer the ship of state into a deeper channel, warning, understanding that there's going to be different policy directives depending on the administration? I don't see that anymore. I also know from my own network in D.C. is that almost to a person, people who I value their expertise have either left the federal government or are leaving the federal government. And they're leaving with such a foul taste in their mouth. The idea of being able to get them back into public service when they've already committed so much of their life to it is going to be really difficult.
Yeah.
This is a huge loss that we're just not taking into consideration. But we need to value people who work in government.
Yep.
And Heather, you're absolutely correct. We're making it so that nobody's going to want to go there except for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and Genius knows no zip code, so we need everybody on this. And that yeah. means people who want to come here to get educated as well.
I think I live in the Genius zip code. I'm just saying. I'm push back on that. 12180. Yeah. RPI.
A lot of stupidity go around too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
makes its way into a lot of the zip codes as well. Yeah. But just saying.
I didn't really mean that. Anyone who's listening, I was joking.
All right, let's go to. We should all have that town pride. I think.
I have an RPI grad too in my family, so he's doing quite well for himself.
Well, hey, Mr. Homeland Security, we can keep our shoes on at the airport. Life is better, right?
Yeah, I was interested in that article.
So this is the TSA is letting travelers skip shoe removal at airport security, and this is...
At some. Right.
Although it does seem to be growing by leaps and bounds, but TSA tests... security lines allowing passengers to keep their shoes on and saying that it will help. They believe that it can still be safe and yet it can help move things faster.
Yeah. And this is an example of the longstanding approach to layered security that the department had been trying to put in place. And sort of for context, for folks that don't remember, there was a man who tried to smuggle explosives into a plane in his shoes, realizing the limitations of some of the systems that would be able to detect.
In the weeks after 9/11.
In the weeks, yeah. Pretty, yes. What the department has been working on and I'm proud to say that this is also a part of why research and development is so important and the relationship with private sector and government is so important, is how to make better detecting systems. So this is a perfect example of changes in science, changes in technology, the implementation and purchase of these systems, the testing of these systems, to the point where the department feels like they can loosen up one of the more sort of onerous elements of air travel.
The best part of the article, though, was the guy who was mad because he had paid for TSA pre-check and now everyone gets to leave their shoes on. He's like, I got ripped off. I'm like, I just want to tell you, buddy, I have a knack for picking the shoes that set the thing off, and I end up having to take my shoes off at TSA pre-check all the time. So. Yeah.
I'll admit to you, Heather, and I understand the eye raising over that. Although it was my first thought.
Really? now what do I get for my?
A question, right? Like if everybody's in the same boat, right?
I mean, but it's I don't know. Just shoes. You can also leave your jacket on if you have TSA pre-check.
And the long term plan was to we had wanted to get, and I say we because this is work that we do with DHS Science and Technology Director, which has pretty much been decimated, was to get to screening at speed. basically the idea that as you're walking through, that screening could occur. So you didn't have the cues. You didn't have the stress of having to take things off and pile things up. And still, it's an aspirational goal. The technology isn't there. The computational abilities are getting better, but they're still not there. But that's exactly what should be happening within the research and development and academic centers, feeding into things like Homeland Security and national security, and they're getting wiped out. In fact, yesterday, Joe, I received notification that a really large grant that we got from Homeland Security that took the MesoNet, the weather data, the real-time weather data, and worked it into both alerts and warnings and decision-making had been cut. I mean, literally days after the disaster in Texas, they eliminated research that we were doing that would have helped save lives in that situation.
Who is they?
The Department of Homeland Security.
Okay. And how does that work then with NOMA, with NOAA, with FEMA, this overlapping of agencies?
Right. So basically, this was work that was being done with NOAA and with Department of Homeland Security, and it's a really good example of sort of the interdisciplinary work that you want to do. And on the university standpoint, this is bringing not just the emergency management and homeland faculty to the table, is bringing the artificial intelligence faculty to the table, the incredible atmospherics work that we do. And this is, in my mind, exactly where the research that's being funded by the federal government should be going, because this is going to allow us to figure out how to integrate in real time better weather data and predictive analytics, which, again, you would want to think about tying into your alerting system so you can say, listen, we're starting to see weather anomalies that could impact that, which is exactly what happened in Texas and then happened in New Mexico yesterday. But it was cut. It was cut, and simply it's a notice that it's at the convenience of the government.
One of the things, our final story, we're just about out of time, but our final story that I had on the docket for today was an overall story about flood deaths rising. And this was an analysis done by the Washington Post. And not surprisingly, this is fueled by heavier rainfall. And in the wake of last week's Texas floods that killed more than 100 people, this analysis found the number of U.S. freshwater flood fatalities has ticked up fairly rapidly in recent years. So even with that information, you're getting the notice that you got this week.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it was just a simple, you're done, wrap it up. Sign a piece of paper and move on, which puts a full stop to all of that research. Equally, I think challenging, and I don't want to go down too far a rabbit hole here, but even the Department of Defense decision to unilaterally stop sharing satellite information with the weather folks and the Homeland Security folks, I don't understand where this is all going, other than we've taken the anti-climate change stuff to the point where it's absurd. It's absurd that the Department of Defense isn't going to be sharing their weather satellite information.
We're out of time. My thanks to all of you. Have a great day, and appreciate you all being here. We'll be back right after this.